Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at Carriage Works at the 2018 Festival.
Good morning, Sydney, and welcome to our temporary home in Redfern, in wonderful Redfern. And firstly, I'll pay my respects to the traditional owners and to elders past and present. First bit of housekeeping, these things, you can do whatever you want on them as long as they're silent. So flick them onto silent. And our hashtag is, what is our hashtag again? Hashtag Sydney Writers Festival. So you've got to spell it out if you're live tweeting. And of course, if you misquote us, you get a free book. No, you don't get a free book if you misquote us. Introducing Hugh Mackay, who I've been reading it now. I think I've been reading you for about 30 years, Hugh, professionally and personally. And he's clearly Australia's premier of the past generation social scientist and commentator on who we are as a nation. And he doesn't need that much introduction, but I just reminded myself the first Mind and Mood report he wrote was in 1979, which from memory, 1979 was about the time that public trust in institutions was at a then record low. And that's the fallout from the dismissal and other matters. I think we're a bit lower today than we were then when you started out. His 19th book is called Australia Reimagined, and we'll get an opportunity, if we don't get all our questions in after our particular discussion, to talk to him at the book signing. And I'm going to throw to Hugh and just get you to give us an overview of what it was you were trying to do with this book. And is this one the last of the big ones on who we are?
Thank you, George, and good morning. Good morning, everyone. It's definitely not my last book. I'd like to emphasise that. There's a couple of other things in my head. But it is my last book of this kind. I think the time for me to be doing big picture, state of the nation, social analysis has come to an end. So this really is my last word on that subject. And one of the consequences of that is, as some people who've been early readers of the book have commented, it is a bit more outspoken than I've traditionally been. I've tried to be the responsible, restrained social researcher, bound strictly to the data. And there's a lot of that in this book, as you know, but I've also broken out a bit and started to dream about the way things could be different.
And just get you describe a deficit, a compassion deficit in the country today. Maybe get you to draw the balance sheet for us, the yes. pluses and the minuses as Australia looks to you today.
Well, perhaps I should begin by just saying that the core theme of the book, the book really rests on two huge facts about Australia, which we all know, nothing mysterious, but which we don't always connect. Fact number one is that we have a mental illness crisis. When Beyond Blue tells us that last year 2 million of us were suffering from diagnosable anxiety disorders, another 2 million had depression or some other form of mental illness. That's 4 million Australians. If we had 4 million Australians suffering from a visible illness, there'd be panic in the streets. But mental illness is often invisible, and we don't always acknowledge just how significant it is. But that was last year's figures, and Beyond Blue and other mental health professionals make the point that in any year at the moment, about 2 million are suffering from anxiety. Anxiety is our number one mental health problem. And the darkest shadow that's cast by that is suicide. The good news is that our suicide rate, our youth suicide rate is coming down. Our overall suicide rate is going up slightly. But to put numbers on this tragedy, between 65 and 70,000 Australians attempt suicide every year. That's the population of a town like Albury. Imagine if all of Albury tried to wipe themselves out in a given year. We'd really have to confront that. So that's fact number one. There is a mental illness epidemic. Fact number two, somewhat more complicated, we are more socially fragmented than we've ever been. We're not alone in this, by the way. This is becoming a bit of a Western story, social fragmentation, with the consequence of increased social isolation. But we're more socially fragmented for all sorts of reasons which are not secret, they're not hidden, nor are they things that we don't like. I mean, the social isolation, social fragmentation is the consequence of things we've been doing to ourselves, not things that have been done to us. For example, our high rate of relationship breakdown. Between 35 and 40% of contemporary marriages will end in divorce. Hugely disruptive and fragmenting for families, extended families, friendship circles, micro communities. Every third, our households are shrinking. You're a long-term trend guy, George, I know. So let's look at the long-term picture. In the last 100 years, the Australian population has increased fivefold. The number of households has increased tenfold. So we've been creating households at twice the rate we've been growing the population, which is another way of saying our households have been getting smaller and smaller. And we've been through this slightly bizarre period in our history that's lasted about 80 years when we thought that the nuclear family household was the gold standard. Before that, and probably again now, we're recognising that maybe three generations under one roof or assorted members of an extended family might make up the households of the future as they did in the past. But right now, we're at the point where in the last census, we learned every fourth household in Australia contains just one person. And in the next 15 years, the ABS says, it'll be one in three. Now, that doesn't mean that that one in three households contains a person who's weeping in the corner, suffering loneliness. Some people absolutely relish, celebrate the freedom and independence that living on their own. I mean, you can whistle out of tune and you can watch daytime television and no one's going to criticize.
I think there's a time in your life where it's compulsory, isn't it?
Yeah, the best
years of your life in your 20s and early 30s when you're living alone.
Yeah. But if you have that many households containing just one person, obviously the risk of social isolation and that, of course, creates the risk of social exclusion and even a sense of alienation. That risk is greatly heightened. It's not surprising that some mental health professionals, both here and in the States, are now saying social isolation is a greater threat to public health than obesity. So that's another factor. Other factors have contributed to this, the falling birth rate, 1.7 babies per woman, way below replacement standard. I mention that in the context of social fragmentation because of the role that kids have traditionally played as the sort of social lubricant, that you move into a new suburb, the kids get to know each other than the families do. But relative to total population, we're producing the smallest generation of kids Australia has ever produced. So that social lubricant is in shorter supply than it used to be. We're compensating, of course. While the birth rate has sunk, pet ownership has increased dramatically. And we know those pets are child substitutes because of the names people are giving them. I recently met a dog called Ian.
Ian the dog.
And I don't know why it struck me as such a weird name for a dog. I mean, I know a Harry and a Fiona. I've never met a George on four legs. But
Have you met a Kevin yet? There hasn't been a Kevin.
I don't think there's been a Kevin. Well, there might be now. So that's another factor. We're more mobile than we used to be. On average, we're moving house once every 6 years, exactly the same as the Americans. We're more mobile, of course, in the car sense as well. We've got almost universal car ownership. That has a socially fragmenting effect because we're not chatting to each other on the footpath. We're waving at the neighbour's car and hoping the neighbour is at the wheel. We're also busier than ever, or we say we are. It's fashionable now even to greet each other by saying, "How are you going? Busy, George? You busy?" As though if you're not busy, you must be dead. Even people who retire are not allowed to say, it's wonderful just sort of floating. They have to say, I'm so busy, I don't know how I ever had the time to go to work. That's the cliche of retirement. So we've got all that. And of course, on top of that, we've got, the reason I mention that, of course, is when people see themselves as busy and are busy, they don't have the time or the energy for engaging with the local neighbourhood. So that's a socially fragmenting and isolating effect, as is really the big one that I haven't mentioned, which is the IT revolution. This huge paradox that it seems to be connecting us while making it easier than ever for us to stay apart. Now, you put all that together, and that's obviously cumulatively going to have the effect of making us a more fragmented, more individualistic society. Now, just to wrap this point up, I began by saying these are two great big facts about Australia, mental illness, especially anxiety, and social fragmentation. Of course, they're not two facts at all. It's one fact. If you have a more socially fragmented society anywhere in the world, but let's think about us, if you have a more socially fragmented society, you will have a more anxious population. There's no mystery about why solitary confinement is the worst punishment we can inflict on a prisoner in our prison system, because we are herd animals. That's the nature of the species. We need each other. We belong together. Cut off from the herd, we become anxious. Even cut off from the herd while gazing at the screen. The recent research on young people's use of social media and IT devices shows that the heaviest users feel most anxious and most socially isolated.
Now, there are a couple of paradoxes you identify in the book, and all of us have looked at some depth at Australia have been struggling with these questions. The data tells us as individuals, we're probably happier than we were maybe 10 or 20 years ago, but we are more fearful about what is happening to Australia. So there's a individual sense that we're okay, but a collective sense that we're not. And flip that paradox back in the other direction. The macro economy is actually still pretty stable. It appears to be stable on the surface anyway. But as individual members of that economy, we're very anxious. So maybe get you to unpack that. Well, it's almost a dual paradox, but a reinforcing one.
It is, absolutely. And I think I was very startled when I came across some of the research showing this gap, this paradox that you've just identified, George. How is it that in a society like ours, people can be generally pretty optimistic about their own lives and generally quite pessimistic about Australia's future? Aren't we in that? You know, aren't we citizens? Aren't we connected to Australia's future? How can we feel as though it's okay for us, going to be okay for us and for our kids, but overall we seem to be on a bit of a downward slide? And things like the housing crisis and increasing income inequality and various other problems we can talk about this morning are things people mention when they say we seem to be in trouble as a nation, but I'm okay. Now, that seems to me to be a manifestation of the problem that I was just identifying. That is to say, if we become more socially fragmented, individualism becomes a kind of cult. The me culture emerges, and we start to think in terms of how is it for me and what's in it for me, and I'm doing okay, so let's just leave it at that. If I can just get an outdoor sink installed in the barbecue area, life will be complete. And don't tell me about asylum seekers on Manus or Nauru. And don't tell me about what appear to be the intractable problems of Indigenous Australia. Don't tell me about 100,000 homeless, minimum. Don't tell me about 60% overweight. Don't tell me about the national debt or the unsustainable level of household debt. Don't tell me about youth unemployment. Don't tell me about the 2 million Australians who are either unemployed or underemployed. I hear that sort of stuff, but we've got the sink now outside and it's a complete thing, and the bathroom renovation is coming on nicely. Now, it is amusing in a way, and it's also tragic in a way. It's sad because it is suggesting to me that we've lost our sense, not totally, I don't mean absolutely everyone has lost it, but we are losing our sense of being part of the whole. And along with that goes the magic word that you mentioned in your intro, George. There's a loss of compassion. Mm. Compassion is one of those words. I mean, it sounds like a sort of bleeding heart, do-gooder kind of word. I think it's worth focusing on what compassion is and why it's relevant to this conversation. I think of compassion as having nothing to do with our emotional state. I think of compassion as a cool mental discipline that anyone who has a sense of the fact that we are all in this thing together can adopt. I mean, the most interesting thing about George and me is the differences between us. But the most significant thing about George and me is that we are part of the whole, that we belong, those significant similarities far outweigh the interesting differences. It's the human species. The human species, like most species on the planet, is a social species. We absolutely need each other. So once you recognise that, you realise that compassion, which I would define as the habit or the discipline of approaching everyone in a spirit of kindness and respect, especially the people we don't like and especially the people we don't agree with, I would describe that as the strategy for being true to our species. And when we become more individualized, that I think is when we develop what you described as the compassion deficit.
And can I get you to maybe walk us back half a step? What you're describing, especially with a sort of highly individualized society, one that is relatively self-satisfied at an individual level but anxious about or concerned about society at large. Mm. But in a way, the concern about society is also fear about the rest of every other member of the society. Mm. Maybe walk you back a couple of steps. Let's take you back to that sort of lucky country period in the 60s where it's parallel but different sense of Australia in those days. It was complacent. I don't think you'd describe us as complacent today. I think we were certainly fairly disengaged with big issues in the 60s, but we're more compassionate then. Is that a good way to put it? Maybe sort of weigh up some of the continuities and discontinuities between those two periods.
I think that is a good way to put it because, and by the way, we just need to remind ourselves that the phrase "the lucky country" we owe to Donald Horne, who published the book
with
that title in 1964.
Yeah.
And of course, he was using it ironically. He was saying, "We're a country who've got by more through good luck than good management." He was absolutely scathingly critical of political leadership and business leadership in Australia and said, you know, we're just lucky, you know, it's wool and wheat at that time. More recently, it's been mining. And curiously enough, during the mining boom, I don't think I would have perhaps used the word complacency, but I did, in a previous book, talk about our dreamy period from the late 90s through really to 2007, when we were kind of lulled into this false sense of security as though the mining boom will go on forever and we'll all be okay, whatever else we do. But yes, back to the 60s, there is no doubt then that there was plenty wrong with us. If you were a woman in the 60s, there was a hell of a lot wrong with our culture at that time. Really, women were second-class citizens, and we have to acknowledge that that is probably the biggest single... That and our acceptance of our multicultural character are probably the two single biggest cultural changes in the years since then. But more broadly, you're right. It was a period when, in spite of Horne's trenchant criticisms, we were a more complacent communitarian society. Public education...
Compassionate, you meant, not complacent. Or complacent communitarian. Okay, yeah, I follow what you just said.
More compassionate. Yeah, sorry, compassionate. I used the wrong word. Yeah, sorry, yeah, yeah. Yes, more compassionate.
Yeah.
No, not more complacent. public education was in its golden period. Mm-hmm. We acknowledged then that that was the way out of poverty and disadvantage for any Australian kid. We knew we were dishing up a world-class education through our public schools, and people who wanted to send their kids to a private school were welcome to do so, and they paid for whatever they paid, whatever it cost. One of the scandals of contemporary Australia compared with that period is that we've got this crazy system, and I've got a chapter devoted to it in the book, this crazy system where now every year the federal government is paying $2 billion to discourage parents from using public education. $2 billion to support non-public schools with public money. This is a national outrage, and all of the fiddling with the funding that we've seen, Gonski 1, Gonski 2, Gonski XYZ, doesn't matter. It's all just fiddling at the edges, not addressing that central issue. In the early 60s, it was just unthinkable that public money would be spent on non-public schools. So that's another big change. The other thing, and you've written about this also, Georgia, but the other thing was we saw ourselves then as an essentially middle-class society. I think you described us as a sort of apple-shaped society, whereas now we're increasingly hourglass-shaped. It's a lovely metaphor or image of this. But we did see ourselves as a broadly middle-class society, a few rich people, a few poor people, but basically we were not classless, but we were certainly middle-class. And in that period, the dream of egalitarianism was still alive and well. Most Australians would have said, we aim to be an egalitarian. So public education was the richest symbol of that, but there were many other symbols. And of course, at that time, we were still much heavier users of public transport. There are lots of things about us then that are different from now.
Although we're reverting on public transport.
Well, we are now, yes.
we have to.
Yes. But the critical thing, I think, comes right to the point you were getting at, is that our sense of belonging to local neighbourhoods and communities was palpable. The idea that you wouldn't know your neighbours in a big city, which is a cliche in a city like Sydney, we don't know our neighbours. Now, Edith Cowan University, what happens when people say they don't know their neighbours? That they're uttering a symptom of social fragmentation, and they're also pointing to a real hazard for our society, which is levels of trust will fall. Edith Cowan University published a few years ago a study in which they showed that only 35% of Australians trust their neighbours. Now, that is an alarming figure. It couldn't possibly mean that 65% of Australians don't have untrustworthy neighbours. It could only mean that 65% of Australians don't feel comfortable, don't know, feel wary. Mm. I mean, we know, for example, that difference makes people wary and defensive until they bridge the gap. And we used to be very good at bridging the gap. You know, with our massive post-war immigration through into the 60s, we were really good at, and we were really good again in the 80s and 90s at welcoming strangers into our midst. So that sense of being part of a local community. Now, of course, this is pre the gender revolution. Mm. And so part of the reason for that was that there were a very large number of states. There was a huge, the baby boom was just ending. The baby boom really tapered off in 1961. And by the way, I heard the Premier of New South Wales talking about a baby boom in part of Sydney. I'd like to know what the figures are. I mean, a baby boom is...
Maybe a baby was born.
that could be it. I mean, our birth rate now is about 1.8, the high 1.7s babies
it per hasn't, woman. It literally hasn't shifted for 40 years. I mean, it's done a little bounce around
the
bottom.
We've had blips. The baby bonus kicked it up for a couple of years.
That was more cohort.
But when we had a baby boom, it was 3.6 babies. That's a boom. We haven't approached that. And nor will we in the foreseeable future. But so we did have a baby. There were babies everywhere in the 50s and 60s, and, of course, a lot of stay-at-home mothers. So the life of the neighbourhood depended on them. Now, that wasn't good for many of those women, and Betty Friedan had to write about that, and subsequently Kate Millett and Germaine Greer and so on. And it was a trigger for a revolution. But from the point of view of communities, it was a very healthy, cohesive period.
There's a couple of thoughts that come out of that compare and contrast. I don't want to straight over go back to the 60s.
Nor do I, by the way. Yeah. I was there. Yeah. I'm not nostalgic for the 60s at all.
But it is an interesting frame of reference for the present. Let's talk a bit more about education. So and the 60s is not a bad way to look at it. The thing that we didn't do well in the 60s was health.
Yes.
So Medibank starts in 72 and then Medicare comes in 83. So when we go around the world, there's basically two things Australians tell, and this is public officials, politicians and even citizens, tell the rest of the world. We've got world-class health system and we took Conservative government took guns off Conservative voters in 1996 after Port Arthur. Now, I tend to view our sort of relatively good performance on health. The flip side of that is that we're actually quite poor when we compare ourselves to other rich nations in terms of education.
Yes.
I think with the exception of South Korea and all the sort of OECD nations, we are the second largest private spender on education of any other rich society on earth. That means the cost of education has literally been shifted from the public to the private account. I'll just get you to unpack what the problems are for social cohesion and ultimately for sense of egalitarianism, equality in Australia when you get that sort of polarity in our education system.
Mm. Yes, thanks, George. The mantra, of course, of people who defend the so-called market education system, the mantra is choice and competition. Mm. Now, what has choice and competition done for us? You've mentioned that OECD comparison. UNICEF did a very interesting analysis last year of the 41 most affluent countries in the world and rated their school education systems. Australia came 39th out of 41. Now, that's what the quasi-market system of education does for you. Ken Boston, who was Director General of Education in this state for many years, highly regarded as an educationalist and educational administrator, was on the first Gonski Review panel, and I think this latest one as well. He has described this as a scandal, as a disaster, as a situation where we're going nowhere with education. The more money we're putting into the more public money that's going into the private system, the lower the standard overall is falling. Mm. Now, the reason for that, of course, is that public schools at the bottom end are being seriously neglected. So when students at the disadvantaged schools perform worse and worse, the average performance inevitably is dragged down. So you can look at the bright, shiny example, some of the selective high schools and particularly a lot of the private schools who produce spectacular results, great. But we're paying a very high price for the fact that those schools are being subsidised by the public purse. I had a moment of truth, which I referred to in the book, where I was being shown around a private girls' school in Sydney and my guide drew my attention to the door furniture. Now, in case you're not familiar with the jargon, the door furniture is the handles. I had to admit they were very attractive door handles. And this person said, "We don't want the girls to feel as though school is shabby compared with their homes." And I thought there was no risk of that. In fact, I thought maybe these girls could do with a bit of shabbiness. But you know, these are the schools that are very often coming out with I know of another private school in Sydney that recently spent over $25 million on a new hall. Where did the money come from? Oh, it was government money. We've been saving all the grants and there was virtually no need for an appeal. There are schools that have million or multi-million dollar operating surpluses in a year, incorporating millions of dollars they get from the government. There was something seriously wrong that would be terrific if we had unlimited funds, but when at the other end of the process we are looking at schools whose performance is just getting weaker and weaker. So it seems to me even the latest recommendations about all this seem to overlook what Ken Boston described as the albatross around the neck of the first Gonski review, which was no school was allowed. Julia Gillard was Prime Minister. She declared no school will receive $1 less of funding as a result of this review. So it wasn't a proper review at all.
So in that dreamy period you described before the GFC, so this is the Howard era. And I know John Howard explained it to me. This is essentially what he was doing with private school funding in the late 90s. There were a lot of there's a lot of development in the outer suburbs, and a lot of those low fee paying private schools were setting up ahead of the state system, and he thought, well, my voters are going there anyway, I might as well flick them some cash to help their kids into those schools. And in a way, in a short-term sense, from a market perspective, the fact that the service was being provided, it didn't hurt for the government to underwrite it. But what happened all the way through the Howard years was wound back a bit by Rudd and Gillard, but it's now come back with Abbott and Turnbull, is it's not just the federal government spending money to deter parents in the state system. I remember the jurisdictions we're describing, federal government, state system, to deter them from going to private public schools. The federal government actually spends more on private schools than it does on tertiary education, which is direct responsibility.
Yes.
So this is almost the bigger deal. Like the choice that the government has made is to tripwire a state education system against the public system, but without any evidence other than maybe electoral advantage.
Yes, and choice sounds like such a terrific word, doesn't it? Mm. We must offer people choice as though this is the toothpaste market. I mean, we're talking about an education system in which we have things like NAPLAN and we're increasingly national curricula and so on. We don't really want choice in terms of what kids are taught. The choice is about the size of the playing fields or the quality of the door furniture or something. But you made a very significant, just a passing remark a moment ago, George, about the cultural and social consequences of this. Because obviously if, as we did in the period you used as our reference point, the 60s, if in the 60s we saw public education as the symbol of the egalitarian dream, what will we say about the egalitarian dream in a society where those $12 billion are going into creating this spurious concept of choice? Obviously, we're now talking about education funding as a significant and deliberate source of social divisiveness.
Inequality, So one of the things to think about now in terms of where, and this is why everybody recognises this as an issue to sort of re-support the public system, a lot of middle-class families have hit that affordability speed hump and are actually being forced to bring their kids back out of the private system to the public system. The data tells you that there's literally been a peak in private school education as a proportion of total student population. So the difficulty governments have now is if you've got no losers at the top end of the market, the bottom end of the market needs to be almost reinvigorated because the middle class is taking their kids there. Put a public policy hat on. How do you fix it without losers?
Well, I've prescribed how to fix it in the book. I think it's a
20-year. That's your invitation.
I think it's a 20-year program, which, of course, in our political culture means it's got no chance. But I think we need to announce today that 20 years from now there will be not a dollar of public money going into the private system. But you can prepare. You've got 20 years to prepare yourselves for this. So don't say we took you by surprise. But who's going to sustain a 20-year program? But that is the only solution to say, look, we've got limited money for this. I mean, the health system. You've made a very interesting parallel with the health system. I mean, the health system has not been an instrument of social division.
Yeah, it hasn't been unpicked.
No,
by political competition. One other thing in sort of this, we're now almost back into my space here with the data-driven question.
Yes.
When we look at housing as another sort of benchmark of egalitarianism or sort of a definition of Australian dream, I'll give you a very, very quick run through the stats. It takes about 2 seconds, trust me. I'm not going to give you too many numbers here. Home ownership was around half the population at the end of the sort of Second World War. And through Chifley and then certainly into Menzies, it's a rocket ship up to about 70%. So the home ownership rate reaches around 70% in the early 60s, and it stays there across, you know, bumps up and down a couple of points either way, but it stays there till the end of the 20th century. We know it's come off a fair way. It's about 5 percentage points. It's around 65 now. Definitionally, the bigger issue is that families with dependent children, which used to be way up here, and they would track the general home ownership rate, they've come down too. Those families, about 250,000 of them on some data I did about a few years ago, and this number's now undercooked, are in the rental market. They end up in the rental market inflating the cost of private rental. The people right at the other end get bumped out of the rental market and become homeless. So you've got two sets of people moving down a rung. Middle class moving from home ownership to rental. People at the margins who need subsidised renting to keep a roof over their head are out on the street. Hugh, I'll get you to talk about that. And in the work that you've been doing over the years, when was it recognised, do you think, in the community that we have it's not just an affordability issue, but a much deeper structural issue about literally Australian aspirations to be able to own your own home?
I think it's relatively recent, George. You know, I think the actual demographic facts have been changing for longer than people have appreciated. Yep. It's often the case with attitudes. I mean, things have to change quite a lot before we realise they've changed and our attitudes begin to change and we get stirred up about them. It's usually, you know, we think that attitudes drive behaviour. It's actually experience that drives attitudes. So that's it's a relatively recent awareness of the fact. I mean, housing, the housing affordability crisis, which has become another mantra, is we've really only been saying that for the last 10 or maybe 15 years. But as you've just said, the issue has been emerging for much longer than that. And of course, it is complicated. I mean, a weird thing about the Australian housing market is that on census night, there were 1 million empty houses. So that's about 11% of the housing stock empty. So actually there's not a shortage of houses, but there's a real issue about utilisation and about the market that drives all this. There is no doubt that we are now looking at a future in which, rather like some of the countries of Western Europe, renting will not be stigmatised. Renting will be the way some people choose to live. People like Phil Riven have been saying for years that we're crazy about this. We need to recognise that rent is not wasted money. Rent is the price you pay for accommodation. You get the accommodation, so you haven't wasted your money. But we have such a ruthless rental market with an emphasis on short-term rental and, generally speaking, a sense of housing insecurity for people who are renting. The breakthrough will come when we begin to talk about really long leases and accept that this is a perfectly reasonable way to live as long as you have housing security. But at the moment, the culture says home ownership is the gold standard. And as you've said, I mean, it's an interesting analysis, which I wasn't fully aware of until you mentioned it. But it is that parents and dependent kids group who are struggling most. We talk about young people, first home buyers, and that's of course who they are. It's complicated by the fact that in the rising generation of young adults, those now moving through their 20s, there are culturally very, the so-called millennials, notice they've got a trendy new label. We used to call them Gen Y. Now suddenly, very sexy, we're calling them millennials, which makes it sound as though they were born in the year 2000, but they weren't.
By the way, let me just cut it. Sorry, I want to congratulate you over 40 years and not trying to invent a different label every other year. The thing that really annoys me about some celebrity demographers is that they think that there should be a label attached to everything they observe.
Celebrity demographers, I'm going to remember that.
Sorry.
We all know who you're talking about.
No, I'm not talking about anyone in particular. It's a general observation.
It's the smashed avocado syndrome.
No, it's not him. It's global. It's a global observation. Sorry.
But anyway, so the millennials are a fascinating generation because they have grown up with an inherent sense of insecurity and instability and uncertainty and unpredictability. They're the offspring of our most divorced ever generation of parents. They've come through a highly competitive education system, a highly competitive labour market. And their mantra, and of course they've grown up with technology that keeps on being superseded every 10 minutes. You know, they've got their iPhone 7, but they're already looking at the next one coming over the horizon. Now that does something to them as a generation. I think of them as the keep your options open generation. Life has taught them to keep your options open. Don't get too settled. Don't rush it. Let's wait and see. And that's whether you're talking about a sexual partner or a job or, to say nothing of marriage and parenthood, they're postponing all of that in unprecedented numbers in the Australian historical context. So when it comes to housing, there's a generational resistance to the idea of a mortgage. And that's another factor that I think is going to drive a completely different cultural attitude in Australia towards renting.
Now, with the one last observation, with the home ownership rate falling, it doesn't, and we know that there are more houses than we probably, I wouldn't say need, but we've got a lot of empty houses, that gap in the market has been picked up by the property investor. So whereas property investors would have been about 7% of the tax-paying population about 20 years ago, they're about 14% now.
Yes.
Okay, so that's literally...
I think even higher in Sydney.
Yeah, so that's literally the difference between the person that would aspire to buy a house is now renting, somebody obviously owns that property and already has another one. So I'm going to take you probably in a direction we didn't plan, but talk me through how you would reconnect Australia between the needs of a younger generation and the needs of an overgeared and with carrying too many properties and with labour market prospects virtually nil as you look forward to all the disruptions, older Australians. Now, these older Australians still carry a lot of electoral weight. How would
they're
you...
used to having muscle. They're used to being...
Well, the other thing is they're overcommitted, so a government can't tell them, by the way, in the interest of of future generations, your kids included, I'm going to rip you off, right? And redistribute your sort of windfall gains back to restitch the social safety net. How do you work out that particular conversation going forward between younger and older Australians?
First of all, I do think, and this sounds just like the Labor Party line, and I'm not running it as a party line at all. I just think, looking at the total housing situation, it is absurd that we've made it so easy for people to invest in additional properties beyond their housing needs, courtesy of negative gearing and massive concessions on capital gains tax. That's completely distorted the market. And until we get rid of those two concessions, I think the market is going to stay distorted in favour of over-investment by those who can afford it or think they can afford it, courtesy of negative gearing. So I'd certainly get rid of that. I think also the baby boomers, who are typically the parents of the millennials, will just have to acknowledge that for much longer than they expected, their adult children are going to be hanging around. And if they go away, they're likely to come back. And there's a lot of hand-wringing about that. But actually, in terms of our cultural future, I see that as a really positive thing. I think the nuclear family household, if you were a visitor from Mars and you looked at the human species and then you looked at how we house ourselves, you'd say, what's this nuclear? Like, who is this good for? You know, the kids just living in this little house with their parents, the emotional spotlight is very intense. Why wouldn't a species like yours keep your households a bit bigger, a bit of multi-generation stuff, a few maiden aunts bringing in, making up the number. You know, let it be a bit more like a human herd, which is what it used to be 100 years ago, so that it's not so intense and so there isn't this desperate need to get out from the intensity of it. So I think that's something that is actually happening and it's not a bad thing.
But triggered by the wrong thing, though.
Sorry?
Triggered by the wrong thing, though.
Oh, triggered by the wrong thing.
John Howard didn't sit there in 2001
doing a cultural service to
us. Yeah, when he tripped up the market so he could get more investors in the market.
No, absolutely. No. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I'd say about this not specifically about housing, but about the intergenerational point you raise, is intergenerational tensions are always with us and have been with us for millennia. Older people have always found very strong grounds for condemning the young, and in particular for condemning the young for not enthusiastically embracing precisely the same values and way of life as the old. It's been going on forever, and it's going on right now with a particular, I think, a particular virulence focused at that. I think the millennials have been our most bashed generation of young adults in living, certainly in living memory, possibly in our history. I mean, the baby boomers copped it a bit because they were a breakout generation, but the millennials have certainly copped terrible press, mainly from their parents' generation, which is very ironic. A couple of things I'd say about that. One is, if we're going to call ourselves a multicultural society, one of the things we'll have to recognise is that a big cultural difference that always exists is intergenerational. And that's part of being multicultural, that we learn to get along with people who, for all sorts of reasons to do with the formative influences in childhood and adolescence, are quite different from the way we were. The responsibility is on the older to learn from the younger. I heard someone recently say, if your kids want to know what it was like in your day, they'll ask you. And of course, they'll never ask you.
But isn't that why we anticipate the question and tell them anyway? We're mind readers, and we know they need to know it. Sorry.
Yeah. But I do think, I mean, this comes back, sorry to get back to what is not an obsession, but certainly a core message in the book, the word compassion. I think we do have to be much more compassionate about intergenerational questions. The idea that we would kick the rising generation of young Australians because they've been formed by a society we gave them is outrageous. We've got to treat them with kindness and respect, and the main sign that you're respecting another person is that you listen to them. And the main sign that you're listening to them is that you are running the risk of changing your mind in response to what you hear. And we've got a lot to learn from them, as they have from us. But why should they listen to us if they think we're not listening to them?
Now, I'll make this a two-part question. I'll give you a chance to summarise what would a reimagined Australia look like. But before we get to that question, I just wonder whether this intergenerational tension is different to all other previous ones because of that extra financial bit to it. So if you think about all the rubbish the baby boomers cop because of the music they listen to and the length of their hair and all that, there was still a massive wealth transfer to them from youth onwards because they're a fairly pampered generation.
Yes.
The millennials, whilst they're better educated than any group we've had before, more mobile, more socially adaptable, more internationalist, more cosmopolitan, their parents are holding
and more all the ready for change.
Yeah, more ready for change, but their parents are holding all the cash. So the thing that might crash the Australian project in the short term is the fact that they're sitting on a pile of assets, but their debts are out to here. And I wonder whether that is fundamentally different to some of the previous ones. It's certainly within the lifespan of the boomer and their parents, their Depression generation parents.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, George. I agree with that analysis 100%. And what that says to me is, therefore, we should be more rather than less sympathetic.
Because of the economic overlay. Because catastrophe is around the corner if you can't,
resolve
it beforehand. Yeah.
There's a quantifiable additional burden that we're asking them to carry.
Yeah. We'll have time for a couple of questions. I just want to give Hugh one last chance to reimagine Australia. Describe, not a nirvana, but describe what it would look like if it were working properly.
Yeah, well, as I said in the book, I've been quite outspoken about things like gender, politics, education, religion and so on. And the Australia that I reimagine would do politics differently, radically differently, would do gender differently, radically differently. I'm recommending we abolish the word feminist, but in a sympathetic way. We would do religion differently. We would do business differently. We would certainly do banking differently. So all of those things would... those big picture things, I think, can do with a lot of serious thought and some radical proposals for change. Why not? You know, why can't we do some of the dramatic things, the equivalent of some of the dramatic things we've done in the past? We've been world pioneers in so many ways. Let's not lose that. That's the big thing. But fundamentally, at the level of individuals and local neighbourhoods and communities, the Australia that I visualise and dream of and yearn for is an Australia characterised by compassion. A country in which we just take it for granted that treating each other with kindness and respect, not in spite of our differences, but because of our differences, would be a society in which we would be much more productive. It would be much more cohesive, much more harmonious than it now is. And I don't think that's by any means an impossible dream. If you go online and look at the Froome Project, F-R-O-M-E, a town in Somerset in the UK, they've just come to the end of a three-year project called the Compassionate Froome Project. And I won't go into all the details because we don't have time, but one of the most significant indicators of the effect of this, which was just, it was a project just encouraging people to get to know their neighbours, smile when you see someone at the bus stop, listen to someone if they need to talk to you, join a choir, join a book club, join a men's shed, you know, get engaged, get involved. Massive commitment to the idea that we've got to regenerate the neighbourhood. Emergency admissions in hospital in Froome went down 17% over those 3 years, while across Somerset they went up 28%.
Okay.
We can do that.
Yep. Thank you, everyone. We've got microphones either end of the stage, and the house lights on so I can see hands shoot up. Let's shoot some hands up. All right, first in, best dressed down the front, and one up there.
You spoke in the very beginning about the intractable issues with Australia's First Peoples. I wonder if you could reimagine the relationship between white Australia and Aboriginal Australia, what that would look like.
Mm. Huge question. And I tread very, very warily because I've got to be frank, I cannot imagine what it's like to be an Indigenous Australian. But I do think that if I were an Indigenous Australian, I would be outraged by all the talk about how we're going to include Indigenous people in the preamble to our constitution. I think I'd be saying, well, that's your constitution. You know, we never had a treaty. We were never consulted about that constitution. Don't make some token mention of us. What about a treaty? What about a council of elders? The very thing the Uluru Statement called for, a council of Aboriginal elders to advise the parliament on Indigenous issues. Until Indigenous Australians are given a significant, properly constituted voice of their own to tell us how we should respond to their problems, many of which we've created for them, we're not going to make progress.
Thank you. You're up here?
Yep. Oh, hi, Hugh. Just in the context of compassion, I wondered how you feel about the way we go after people who stuff up our community leaders, our business leaders, sports leaders, how we go after them when they do stuff up in a very personal way.
Our media have a lot to answer for in encouraging the compassion deficit, as George expressed it. So let's not be seduced by that. Let's not think. It's very easy to wring our hands about the state of the nation. Very easy to say, if only we had different leaders, if only we had different media, how much better it would be. It is true that in the media, nothing is more attractive than conflict, attack, belittling people, humiliating people, etc. Let's not follow that example. We can't change the media except by switching off. I mean, you know, I was talking to someone recently who mentioned a particular paper that they've given up buying, and I felt able to congratulate them on that decision. If you think a program is outrageous, turn it off. You know, if you think a paper has an editorial line that is unsympathetic or the sort of thing you've described is their characteristic, don't buy the thing. That's what they understand. But much more importantly than any of that, don't follow the example. If we think that there are things wrong with the way people are treated in the media in this country, make sure we treat them differently in our street. In other, it sounds like a slogan, but it's a recurring theme in the book that the state of the nation starts in your street, that the best way to measure the health of a society is by assessing the health of local neighbourhoods and communities. Now, it is true, as the Banking Royal Commission, as the Child Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse in Institutions showed, that there are certain very, very prominent, very senior people who've misbehaved so badly and who've eroded our trust in institutions. They deserve to be gone after because they've let us down in a personal way. But as you say, many of the people who get attacked are not in that category. I think that's a different question. Yeah.
Hi, Hu. I'm over here. In Perceptions Matter, which was a common cause values study in the UK, they found that 74% of citizens had compassionate values over selfish ones. Mm. But 77% of people believe that they held them, but their fellow citizens and neighbours didn't.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So that's that's a bit like the gap here that George mentioned earlier.
Yes. And what they talked about was the values that are propagated or propagandised by institutions, whether they be schools, media, government, that you've got to look after yourself and only you. But we don't believe that, but we're afraid to say it for being thought of wussy or hippie or left-wing or whatever. Yeah. What are your thoughts about how to encourage more Australians to reveal their compassion?
Mm. Look, I'm a great believer in personal example. When we are acting compassionately, when we really are stopping and chatting to someone in the street, in the suburb, in the local cafe, the ripples go out. You know, acts of compassion tend to multiply. That's one of the nice characteristics of human society. And I think individually, you know, if we all went out of here this morning and said, look, I am going to be a little bit kinder to that eccentric person, or I'm going to be a bit more patient with the person who'll never shut up, I'll be more respectful to the people I really don't like because they play their music too loudly, whatever it is. You can make a huge difference, but we start, as most social revolutions do start, in a very small way, with individuals taking small steps. Gradually, over time, we become a different kind of society. And I think it's sad that the people who think they themselves are compassionate think everyone else isn't. What that means is they haven't been talking to their neighbours.
No, sorry, they're afraid that if they speak up, they will be condemned. So there's a real tension.
I don't know whether that's true in Australia.
Well, it would be great if it wasn't, but the UK survey definitely showed it was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would deeply disturb me if that were true in Australia. But even if it were, all that means is you have to be both compassionate and courageous. You have to get on with it.
We'll take a quick question and give you a chance for a quick
speaking question. As a so-called sexy millennial. How do we achieve...
I didn't say they were sexy. I said the label was sexy.
How do we achieve a future that you envision when we constantly, as millennials, turn off from politics because it seems like a constant basket case?
Mm. Yeah, we need a radical rethink of politics. There's an entire chapter about that. This isn't a one-word answer. There is absolutely no point in bleating about politics unless you engage with it. When we say we get the... As a famous Frenchman once said, nations get the governments they deserve, that's absolutely true, and it's most true in this sense, that if we do disengage, if we shrug and say, this is all hopeless, aren't they awful, what a disappointment, etc., that's when we get the government we deserve. We have to re-engage. We have to write to MPs. We have to demonstrate. We have to join parties if necessary. Although I think there's a better system, and I'll leave it to you to discover it for yourself. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're now a minute and 2 seconds over time, according to this mad overtime clock I'm staring at. You can't see it on stage. Before we all give Hugh a hand, a round of applause. Bay 19, I think it's the next bay to this one, is where the book signing table is. So if you've got any more questions to ask, you don't have to buy a book, but it'd be nice if you also bought his book. But come and say hello. I'll be there too. And now that we're done and well and truly over time, please extend a warm thank you to Hugh Mackay.